Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Tales of the Cocktail in New Orleans, Louisiana. Nastasha, as always, is back in Bushwick, Brooklyn, at Roberta's Pizzeria, with Jack and Joe and the rest of the Heritage Radio gang. How you doing, guys?
Good. Nastasha was just telling me how much she likes Brooklyn.
No, I wasn't.
Really? Were you actually saying that, or is it more anti-hipster vitriol?
That was a lie.
It was a lie. I said they're having their block party, and I said I wish I liked Brooklyn so that I could come.
Well, let's push their block party. When's the block party?
It's on Saturday. You know what? We'll play the block party commercial on one of the breaks. It's a trip.
Yeah.
It is a trip.
Right. Block party. If you like going to Brooklyn and you like block parties, two things I actually detest, because being outside in the daytime and like large groups of people, like I detest when they shut down, no offense to people who love it, but I detest like street fairs in New York when they shut down whole avenues and then you like walk up and down and it's all the people. You hate that too, Nastasha, right?
Yeah, I hate it. My friends love it.
I hate it too.
Yeah, but it sucks. I mean, who needs it? I mean, I can go to a regular store and buy a pair of socks. Isn't that what they sell there?
Yeah, but the corn, I must, is pretty good. Like the corn and butter and chili sauce. All the
arepas.
Weird stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, arepa, fine product, bad name. Yeah, okay, I'll hand it to you on that, but...
Yeah. The shirts and the socks and underwear are bad.
Yeah, but all the people, sheets. And then like we always need to move equipment whenever there's one of those things, and then you hit them, and then the traffic is insane and all this other...
Why
doesn't anyone just set up a shop to sell arepas and corn, a real freaking shop, and then you would know, hey, I want like a giant thing of corn dipped in butter with some spice sprayed at that thing, and I could just go to the shop and get that thing. You know what I mean?
Because they have to pay rent at a shop, the street fair.
Yeah, but there's plenty of things that you have to pay rent for that people go and shop for and purchase. Why not corn? How much is one of those ears of corn at the thing?
Say a dollar.
It's a dollar?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, come on. I mean, that doesn't cost them almost nothing, I'm sure. I guess the problem is that it's seasonal because you're only getting corn in the summer, and then what do you dip in butter for the rest of the year?
I don't know.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they don't want to move to, like, a frozen ear of corn situation. Those things are always disappointing. The frozen ear of corn, you ever had that?
No.
You buy the frozen ear of corn in the supermarket, and then you try and cook it, and you hope it's going to be as good as corn is, in, like, July, August, but it isn't?
No.
No, don't start. If you haven't started already, don't start now.
How's New Orleans?
I mean, I literally just, got here, checked into the hotel, and then, started doing the research for the show. But it's, like you'd expect, hot as hell.
Mm-hmm.
Humid. And the cocktail people have already descended. So for those of you that don't know, every year, right around now, there's Tales of the Cocktail, which for the cocktail industry is the biggest kind of, it's the biggest event of the year. A huge chunk of the kind of, whatever you want to call them, cocktail intelligentsia, whatever the hell you want to call them, from all over the country, in fact, the world, fly in here to learn from each other and, I guess, drink a lot. And they have it in New Orleans in the middle of the summer because no one else wants to be here, and only the cocktail people are dumb enough to come to New Orleans, in the middle of the summer when it's a billion degrees and 100% humidity. But the advantage is hotels are cheap right now. Hotels are cheap here. It's like $100 a night to stay in New Orleans right now.
Mm.
And then Nastasha, not a big fan. Okay. By the way, calling your questions live to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. I believe we still have an open line to take a caller in, even though I am using one to call in from my hotel room.
That's correct.
First question from Fred. Hey, Dave, Nastasha, Jack, Indie Jesus, and all the rest. Which, by the way, just say Joe. You don't see all the rest. This is like one of those situations. This is one of those situations, like with the Skipper and Marianne, with the Gilligan's Island, where all they had to do was say one last person, and instead they just say the rest. It's Joe.
But they might be on like back podcasts, and they haven't caught up yet.
Yeah. All right, anyway. And remember, Indie Jesus is no longer part of our crew.
They might be on the old podcast. They might be catching up.
Right, right. But for, so you know, Indy Jesus, because he hates Nastasha, has quit the shift that's on Tuesdays.
Yes.
So we might have to switch our radio show day to match up Indy Jesus'
Sunday,
Steve.
Sunday, no. No.
Sunday?
It's crazy,
nah,
that, it's
I don't
crazy
want to
that Jesus works on Sunday, though.
No. Anyway, okay. Fred writes in, I recently picked up a turkey roaster. It's a Hamilton Beach model 32503. Is it possible to deep fry in one of those things? How good is the temperature control? Thanks, Fred. Okay, so what we're talking about are these ovens that, well, kind of ovens. They look like giant crock pots. This one, I looked it up. It's 18 quart, which is, I think, one of the standard sizes. This particular model discontinued, but they have a pan that you can pull out and wash out. You throw the turkey on top of a rack into the pan, and you roast your turkey, and it theoretically it's faster. Also, it frees up your oven so that you can, on Thanksgiving time, use your oven for all the rest of the nonsense that you need your oven for and cook your turkey in this kind of basically this, in quotes, oven. It's kind of like, you know, like a Dutch, it's like cooking in a Dutch oven with its own heat source. And I think I mentioned on the show once or twice that I had one of those that I bought at a thrift shop from the, you know, it was from the 60s or something like that, and I bought it in a thrift shop in college, and I used to bake bread in it. And I loved it. It was great. Smelled horrible because there was something wrong with the insides of it, but it still worked great, and it made great bread. Well, great bread for that. Great bread for a dorm room, let's put it that way. I mean, I don't, you know, not great bread compared to what our listeners think of as great bread. Anyway. Will it work as a deep fryer? It clearly gets hot enough to work as a deep fryer, and I looked up the wattage on a representative one. I couldn't find the exact one to find the wattage, but the wattage is somewhere in the area of 1,400 watts. I doubt you're going to find a fryer that plugs into a normal socket that's much higher than that. Like maybe it would go up to 1,500 watts, maybe a little bit higher. But none of the electric plug-in fryers really have as many watts as I would want them to have. Because the key for frying is, of course, fast recovery. Now, the way that these things work is the pan that you put into it with the turkey in it rests on the plate that's actually doing the heating. So you're going to have some issue about some heat loss in between the plate and the pan. But I'm mostly worried about stuff falling to the bottom and scorching on the bottom as the heater clicks off and on. I don't think the heating control is going to be very accurate at all. But I don't think it's that necessary to have super accurate heat for deep frying. But I think your main problem is going to be scorching of particles on the bottom, because a fryer that's really, really good at its job isn't going to be heating the electrical element. It's not going to be the very bottom of the unit. The element will be floating somewhat above the surface of the oil, such that particles can fall underneath it and not scorch on the thing that's actually being heated. It's a better way to fry, especially, it doesn't matter so much if you're doing something like donuts, because donuts don't throw off a lot of little particles. But if you're doing something like chicken, in a batter, and the batter is going to fall off, those little bits of flour get burnt and are going to get nasty against the bottom of the pan. That said, it should work. I do not think anyone will actually recommend that you do it, because I'm sure the insurance on a fryer is a lot more, and you want to make sure you don't have it overflow and ignite and or burn you or scorch you or anything like that. So I'm not going to make any claims to the safety of it, but I mean, it should be able to do an okay job. Now, here's the other problem. 1,400 watts is going to be enough power for a small, small fryer to get up really hot really fast, but 1,400 watts distributed over something the size of an 18-quart roasting oven is not going to be that much power. And in the end, so even though it's fairly powerful for what would be a home fryer, it's a lot bigger than what a home fryer would be, and so I think it's going to be sucking wind when you throw stuff in it. So if you were to heat it up to temperature and only throw a couple little things in, you might be able to get good results, but I would bet that if you really loaded it down with, like a whole fried chicken or something like that, that the temperature would drop drastically and that you'd have some problems. But that's just my guess. If it is powerful enough for you and you just don't think the temperature control is good enough, you could buy a simple PID, PID temperature controller and a thermocouple and bypass the thermostat entirely. Just plug it. Although you don't want PID. You got to switch it, turn it off of PID, which is going to be a very accurate temperature control. And for deep frying, you want on-off. But most good PID controllers that you buy, you can turn them into on-off controllers, right? So a PID controller, like, it's just going to slowly get up to the temperature and not over. overshoot. You don't care if you overshoot a little bit. You just want it to get up there fast. So as soon as the temperature of the oil drops, you want it to go on full blast. But then you can have an external control that can be very accurate, and as accurate as an on-off or bang-bang thermostat can be. And that wouldn't add that much to the cost, but you might have a power problem. What do you think, Stas?
That's a good answer.
Good answer? All right. From Colin, dearest y'all, could you revive this question? Are pressure cooked jams a good idea? So I had to go back, I think it was in May, and found Colin's question on pressure cooked jams. A few weeks ago, I bought a whole boatload of kumquats and made marmalade. And then he wanted to know, could marmalade or jam in general be prepared in a pressure cooker to prevent the loss of volatile flavors? Because he realized that the smell that he was that was coming off of the pot was a smell that was being lost. Right, that's the theory. Right, and so basically, he says what I understand is happening is that the boiling temperature of the marmalade or jam solution increases as water is being boiled off, and that stopping at a particular temperature in a pressure stopping at a particular temperature when you're cooking a jam is equivalent to stopping at a particular hydration level or amount of water or the solids level that's in it, and that we add extra water to a jam recipe because the pectin needs time to cook and break out, and there you have it. So the question is, could he seal the mixture in a pressure cooker and cook the jam without losing water or volatiles and get an equivalent texture with improved flavor? The boiling temperature will increase at the increased pressure, but do you think that will affect the pectin properties of the jam overall? I suppose there could be more thermal breakdown of flavor in a pressure cooker despite the decreased loss of volatiles. What are my thoughts? Okay. Well, if you're going to do it this, first of all, here's the issue. If you knew, I'd have to do some research, and maybe during the commercial break I can look it up because I forgot to look it up. But what you need to know is the actual solids level of the jam that you're shooting for. If the solids level, the bricks, is reasonable, like on the order of 60% or thereabouts, 70% even, then you could probably just add the ingredients to a jar in a pressure cooker, seal it, so that even if you had a venting pressure cooker, which I don't like using, I like using non-venting pressure cookers in general because they, I think, they do a better job with flavor, but if you're sealing in a canning jar, it doesn't make much difference. And pressure cook it at that higher temperature, you could conceivably get a product that will work. But you have to know beforehand what the solid level of the fruit pulp is, and then therefore calculate how much sugar to add to it, and you'd have to get it fairly accurate. That is all doable, and if, I don't know, maybe if Jack or Joe has the time to research while we're talking the Brix level, B-R-I-X level of jam or jelly, we could do a ballpark estimate of whether or not it's feasible to just add all the ingredients, sugar, fruit, etc., into a jar and pressure cook it. But, it might be possible. I don't know. It would be difficult because you'd have to make sure you got it right every time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you have a caller.
Oh, caller, you are on the air.
Hey, Dave. Hey, Jack. Hey, Stas. How's it going?
Good.
This is Matt from Chicago.
Howdy.
Hi. I had a question about low temperature cooking of skirt steak.
Okay.
I tried it sous vide with a recipe I found on the web, and it was as tough as had I cooked it for, over a flame for hours. And I'm wondering if you had any ideas on how to get better results.
Give me the recipe that you used.
I don't remember. That's the problem. I think it was the one on the PolyScience website.
How long did you cook it?
Jeez, it seems like maybe 2 hours.
Yeah. And so here's the thing. So if you're cooking a skirt steak, I like to do skirt steak low temp. But what temperature you cook the skirt steak to is entirely dependent upon how long you cook it, right? So if you're only going to cook the skirt steak for a couple of hours, you're going to need to go fairly high, like 57 Celsius, let's say, which is a good number, 57 Celsius, if you're going to do it for like an hour or 45 minutes or an hour and a half like that. Then you have to cool it down, and then sear it, because a skirt steak is so thin that if you were to try to sear it directly out of the circulator, it just overcook, and you might as well not have done low temp at all. Okay.
Okay. I think I did sear it afterwards immediately. So.
Yeah. I mean, you have to sear it afterwards, really, or the texture is not going to be
sure.
very, very good. You know, but
sure. But
you know,
go ahead.
Yeah, the other way to do it is to cook it down near where you'd cook a ribeye, so like 55, for a long time, like 9-10 hours,
okay.
or you know, and then let it cool down again, and then just take it and hard sear it, and that will actually warm up the inside and overcook the outside a little bit, but that's going to give a really, really high quality tender skirt steak. The alternative, right, is to sear it beforehand like it's a normal skirt steak, and then just quickly throw it into like a bag and let it come up to temp in a circulator. The problem is your crust isn't going to be that great afterwards.
Yeah, and
you know what I mean.
It's not really a good candidate. It isn't a good candidate for the double sear. I take it. Or is it?
Well, you can. I've done a double sear on it, and what the advantage of the double sear is that the second time you sear it, it's going to color and crust up really quickly.
Yeah.
But you know, then you might run the problem that you know something goes wrong and you dry it out a little bit. I would definitely not on skirt steak pre-sear it before you low temp it.
Okay.
Because it's going to cure through fairly quickly with the salt. I would definitely, I mean, pepper is fine or whatever marinade you want, but I would not salt it until right before the second sear.
Okay, that's interesting. I actually use lime juice in my marinade, and it just makes it absolutely delicious. And I usually just do it the standard, you know, just sear it in a real hot pan after it's marinated a while and don't even bother with low temp, but I figured I'd try it. I've got a rig in my basement for low temp cooking for sous vide, and I figured I'd try it because you know I'm trying everything sous vide now that I got the rig. And some things have turned out really good, but the skirt steak is one thing that did not. And I was just curious if you had any thoughts. So I appreciate your input.
Here's what it is. Do this, and you're gonna love this. This is the way that I actually cook skirt steak. Right? I would not sear it beforehand. I would do your marinade or whatever else you want to do, put it in the bag, cook it. If you don't have the time, 57 for, like I say, like an hour or so, or like 55 for longer, like 6-7 whatever hours, it's going to get more tender. Let it cool down, and then you can even have it in the fridge, pull it out, and do your hard sear on it just like you were cooking it normally, and what you'll just have is you can focus on that crust, and you just have a much more tender skirt steak on the inside than you would with a normal cooking technique.
Right. I'll give that a shot then.
Alrighty, let us know how it worked.
Alright, thanks a lot, guys. We'll talk to you later.
Hi, no problem.
You have another call, Dave.
What?
You have another call.
Okay,
hi,
caller,
hi.
You're on the air.
Hi, yeah, afternoon. How are you?
Good. I'm doing alright.
Alright, so I'm a bit of a home brewer, and I've been doing a little bit of shopping at the Modernist Pantry, and I've been referred to you to a solution for a problem that I've been having. I've been working on making cream liqueur, and I've purchased some sodium caseinate from the Modernist Pantry, and I was initially under the impression that that might help me to combine my dairy with my alcohol that I've been producing, and it's stable for a little while, but I let it sit out at room temperature for about 6 hours. And I've put it next to a very small amount of already store-bought cream liqueur, and the store-bought cream liqueur remains stable. However, mine, it doesn't split, per se. The dairy molecules from the water molecules, it just separates into layers as a thicker, homogenized cream on the top and a more watery, less viscous liquid on the bottom. I'm doing further research, and I'm finding out that glycerol monosterate might help me out, GSM. But I was wondering if you had any advice as far as to how I would implement the GSM if I were to obtain some, and if I may be using the the sodium caseinate incorrectly.
Okay, well, I mean, I have a lot of experience with emulsified alcoholic beverages, but not making cream liquors as such. What you're using actual cream?
Well,
with fat in it?
I did one batch with a splash of cream, and then I did another batch with a splash of milk. I also tried making my own condensed cream. And using I think I used malt powder, a little bit of sugar, and milk, and a little bit of vanilla, and I made like a condensed milk, and tried to use that. I thought maybe the sugar would be a decent buffer to help bind the dairy to the liquor. I don't know if maybe my alcohol content is something that might be affecting it. I'm at about 22% alcohol content, so
okay.
I'm not sure.
Are you?
Maybe
but So you're not curdling at all. You're just getting phase separation.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm guessing that. I mean, I've never researched like Bailey's or anything like that to see like what the fat content of Bailey's is. But if you're getting a phase separation, it just sounds like you need an emulsifier in there. What you're mentioning is, is an emulsifier. The one that I typically use in the drinks at Booker and Dax is probably won't work for your application, or it might, is a mixture, and this is not what the cream liqueur people use at all, but is a mixture of, it's gum arabic, which acts as an emulsifier, and xanthan, which acts as a stabilizer. Now, you probably want to go to kind of a more of a hardcore emulsifier. When you get the phase separation, if you just rock it back and forth, does it go back together or no?
It does to an extent, but I think it's more of like the temperature that it's been sitting at for a while, because all the ingredients I'm mixing them sort of like the dairy is just from the fridge. I haven't been able to sit down and test it from letting the dairy sit out. Room temperature. I also found that heat became a factor in the initial combination. It was important that the dairy was warm in order to get the emulsification to work initially. And then once it cools down and it sits and it settles at room temperature for a while, it eventually separates. And I can get it to come back together, but then once I let it sit for about another half hour after spinning it back together, it'll separate again.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do. This is an interesting thing. I should know this just because of what I do for a living. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to figure out what they do in the industry to make cream liqueurs, and whether or not what the fat level, if any, is of those things, and kind of figure out how they do it. And then I'll come back probably not next week, because next week I don't know if I'm going to be able to have the radio show, because I'm going to be in the air on the way to California, I think. But the week after that, I'm going to come back and answer that question. I'll give you a much more definitive answer, okay?
Okay. And if by chance, you are in the city right now, right?
I'm in New Orleans at Tales of the Cocktail.
Okay. I was under the impression that you were in Manhattan or in New York City. Would you be able to also, I know that you say you're going to be going back on the air with these answers, but would there be any way you might be able to contact me directly?
It's possible. When you go off, give Jack your info, or maybe we could tweet it out or something like that. Alrighty?
Alright. Thank you very much for your time. Would you think that if I were to purchase some glycerol monostearate, do you think that might be a decent avenue to approach?
I don't want to say yes or no off the top of my head without really doing the research on it.
Alright. Thank you very much for your time.
Hi, cool. Alright, so right before we take the break, Joel Gargano writes in, who, by the way, is from New Haven, which is where so Jack wanted to know, does anyone want the Bluto, the music from my college days? And we got the first person in, says that they like that. Here's what he writes. I wrote in a few months back about soy whipped cream. Your advice helped, and I made some adjustment. It turns out that soft tofu, coconut milk, and some stabilizers works great right out of the siphon, the whipped cream siphon. But more importantly, I want more Bluto. This crap is heavy.
Wow.
Do we have a link to any of this anywhere? So, Jack, we have someone that wants the Bluto.
Wow. There it is.
Right?
So when you return...
Yeah.
Oh, by the way,
Joel, no Bluto today because it's only on my iPhone, and we don't have it actually copied over onto the Heritage Radio computer. So we're gonna have to go because.
By the way,
says,
Dave.
Enough of the cheesy jazz. No offense, I like jazz. Plus, he also wants pictures of me getting my face smashed in on stage, which I don't think actually exist, unfortunately. But you know, he wants like stage diving pics and stuff like that. And then his suggestion is that we start a band where you know, I guess he's going to come in and start a band with us where we write about Maillard reactions and agar-agar clarification. And he wants to call it Maillard and the Reactors. He's going to let me have bass solos in every song, but he only wants to do it if we can get Indie Jesus to be the front man. What do you think, Jack?
Ooh, we'll have to see. That's going to be tough. He's in high demand.
Yeah, I'm sure every band in Bushwick wants Indie Jesus as the front man.
Why wouldn't they?
Yeah, right? I mean, even Nastasha would go to see Indie Jesus as a front man, and she hates hipster bands. Loves bands. Nastasha, by the way, like one of her great lifetime skills is to be able to get into any concert for free and go backstage without having to perform any sort of awful acts.
I retired that.
You're retired, but it's a great skill. It's like I can shotgun a beer very well, also a retired skill of mine. I don't go around shotgunning beers anymore.
You wanted to do it at the Jimmy Fallon show. It wasn't retired. It hasn't been retired.
I didn't shotgun a beer at the Jimmy Fallon show.
You asked if you could, remember?
I was joking. Joking. Mm-hmm. Plus, they only have... By the way, for those of you who don't know, we're on the Jimmy Fallon show, and one of their sponsors is Bud Light Platinum, which is basically Bud Light where they add some extra booze to it. It's like straight up, they add extra booze and they put it in like a blue bottle that looks like kind of like a Saratoga water or a Tynan bottle. But you can't shotgun out of a bottle, Stas. It shows
what
you know about.
You asked them if they had cans so that you could shotgun.
Yep.
Yes.
A joke. Mm-hmm. A joke. I no longer shotgun, although I am quite good at it. I'm retired. Anyway, okay, so why don't we go to our first commercial break? Come back with more cooking issues.
White Oak Pastures is a 146-year-old multi-generational family farm that works in cooperation with nature to produce artisan meat that is safe, healthy, nutritious, and good to eat. Without fail, we ensure that our production practices are economically practical, ecologically sustainable, and that the animals are always humanely treated. We never falter in our determination to conduct our business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
You're currently listening to Brothers NYC, Real Long Way to Go, band fronted by our very own Damon Bolte. And we're coming back.
Dave Wepop is on the air.
Wait, Damon Bolte fronts a band?
Yeah, well, I guess he's not the front man, but he's the lead guitar. That's his band.
Is his twin also in the band?
Yeah, that's why they're called brothers.
Oh, yeah. See, it's hard for me to hear over the telephone. I can't hear anything. So we got Wepop Soupy Pot slash Bam on the phone?
Yes.
Hi, Dave Nassad, Dan Jack.
Hi.
This is Wepop.
Wepop!
What's up? How's everything going?
Going well. So for those of you that don't know what's going on, Wepop Soupy Pot, a.k.a. to the rest of the world, Bam, just got his Kickstarter fully funded, and they are making a relatively low-cost, simple-to-use-at-home immersion circulator. And what's the cost of this sucker?
It is $359.
359. All right, 359. And, you know, I don't know, go on the... I don't know, how do you buy one of these suckers?
So, right now, Kickstarter campaign's closed. So you just go to shop.namiku.com to pre-order one.
Now, what's your ETA for actual units?
ETA for, by Christmas.
And wow, by Christmas.
We're gonna give, we have a lot of demands. We're going to give priority to the Kickstarter people. But we're still working that out. It should be the same batch.
All right.
We'll see.
So I hear that you have something to discuss over the Cooking Issues airwave regarding this.
Oh, hello?
Silence.
Sorry.
Silence.
Cut off.
So I guess not.
No, I didn't hear you.
Oh, you told me you wanted to speak about Ziploc bags.
Oh, no. We have a lot of emails coming in. You know, people being concerned with Ziploc bags. And, you know, I feel like a lot of people still have issues with cooking in plastic. So
right.
what we've been doing
specifically
is that,
Ziplocs, though, as opposed to, you're not getting any calls in with questions about cooking in sous vide cook chill bags, right? You have people calling with
right.
questions on the the wisdom of using Ziploc bags for
right.
cooking low temp, right?
Right.
Yeah. Here's my thought. And the reason, I guess, is because on your Kickstarter campaign video, there is a picture of someone putting food in a Ziploc to do the cooking with your device. What's your device called again?
The Namiku.
Namiku.
N-O-M-I-K-U. Yeah, Namiku.
So,
what's that
my
mean?
Feeling on
what's
Ziploc bags. I think I might have told the story once, but I could tell it again. I was doing the Martha Stewart show, and they decided to just have like a bunch of like tech fools on. So, Nathan was on via Mirvold was on via he wasn't actually on. They showed she did a tour. Martha Stewart did a tour of his lab there, and they had Grant Aitkes was on. And I was on. And so I was talking to Grant backstage. Grant Aitkes, of course, from Alinea. I was talking backstage that he was getting a lot of flack from S.A. Johnson Wax, a family company, which is, I believe, the people that make the Ziploc bag. Basically, they yelled at him because he had a video on the web where he was using a Ziploc to do his low-temperature cooking. And I think it's really strange that they have a problem with it, or that anyone has a problem with it, because the Ziploc bags are rated for reheating in a nuke, right? I mean, it says right on it that you can reheat stuff in them in a nuke. The issue is, a Ziploc bag, and I could be wrong, but I'm not, is made out of polyethylene and food grade, obviously polyethylene, and it's the same stuff that most plastic wrap is made out of, polyethylene. And what it can't do is get anywhere near the boiling point of water, 100°C, because it gets very, very soft there, and that's very close to the melting point. However, it works fine in the 50s, and I never really take it above the low 60s ever, because I don't have a need to, Celsius, that is. But in that range, they are perfectly fine, and I can't understand any argument against using Ziploc bags for cooking low temp at those temperatures, so long as you aren't assuming that you're preserving something for any length of time because you haven't put a vacuum seal on it, so long as you're not heating it above any other above in the 60s somewhere. I can't see any argument whereby cooking in any form of plastic would be okay and not in a Ziploc under those circumstances.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying?
So, like, the food savers and a lot of, side sealers that are on the market, they're using the same kind of material, and somehow those are being, like, promoted for use with, like, the Sous Vide Supreme or whatever.
Right. Well,
and,
those cook chill bags, like even cooked chilled, I mean, polyethylene is a good choice, and I'm having a little trouble hearing you, but polyethylene is a good choice for food applications just because it doesn't have to have plasticizers in it, and it doesn't react with food very much. Usually those bags that were rated to higher temperatures will have multiple plastic layers, and so that they keep their integrity at higher temperatures. But again, like most of this is completely moot because we're keeping our temperatures very much lower than is ever going to be a problem when we're using low temperature cooking. So I literally, except for the fact that Johnson, SC Johnson Wax doesn't, I believe it's SC Johnson Wax, does not want to have any sort of liability from saying you can cook in their bags as opposed to, you know, reheating in a very specific way. Because they don't want to assume that liability, they just say you can't do it, and then that them saying you can't do it is just getting promulgated on the web and by people. I mean, I don't really understand any other sort of argument. I would love to hear from somebody what that argument is, but I haven't heard any good reasons.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And also, thanks for the mention last time on Heritage Radio. So our Namiku is actually 750 watts. And some people have been saying, oh, that, you know, that's too low, whatever. But then I think for the purpose of maintaining perfect temperatures, I think 750 watts is way more than enough. What do you think?
Well, that was the one question I had when I talked about it on the air was, what was the reason you went 750 instead of the full 1,000 that most of the other companies are using?
Well, that's just the type of heaters that we're using. And for the size that we're able to get it down to, we've matched it up with 750 watts. We've had some 1,000 watts prototypes, however. But it doesn't make much of a difference, like how fast. Like you can heat the water.
Like, well, what size bath were you testing on?
Relatively the same. Just the regular. I think the 12 liter, like fan.
Yeah, I mean the ones where like the 1,000 watt circulators start crapping out. Anytime you go above a normal full size Lexan, and then they start sucking wind. So I mean I think it, what you're doing by any sort of power limitation, what you're doing is you're just capping the upper size of the water bath that you can reliably heat with it.
Right.
You're also capping the recovery rate of it when you drop a large food load into it. So for instance, you simply you can't maintain easily any temperature. It also depends on the temperatures you're trying to get to. It's a lot easier to get a water bath up to 55 Celsius, let's say, than it is to get a water bath up to 85 Celsius, let's say, because there's a lot more losses to the atmosphere because the water wants to go off a lot more as vapor at those temperatures, and so you're having to put a lot more energy in. You're getting, it's proportionally a higher temperature relative to ambient, and so you have to drive it harder because you have higher heat losses out of your vessel. So a normal 1,000 watt circulator in a large Lexan that's higher than the one that I normally recommend, I can't really get it to go above about 55, and I can't it doesn't really drive an accurate temperature at those levels. When you drop big loads into them, and so I only recommend using giant baths like that with a circulator for reheat, where the temperature isn't as accurate. The need for accuracy isn't as high. So, if you were cooking a smaller in a smaller vessel, like a half Lexan, let's say, then I'm sure 750 watts is fine. But my question would be, is how would a 750 perform in a full size Lexan versus 1,000 watt? I don't know. I've never done it. You know what I mean? So I can't tell you. Those are just my concerns. I would bet for 90% of the people, if you were going to work at home, very few people at home need to drive anything bigger than a half Lexan.
Right, and that's correct. That's why we've designed the Namiku to work with, you know, pots of any size from 3 quarts and up. So we actually, that was the size that we had in mind, and 750 watts is more than adequate for those purposes.
Yeah, cool.
So, you know, anything bigger than the leg stand, then, you know, you're going a little bit overboard.
This well, for a house, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
You know, by the way, WePop, you know, you're in Bangkok now, right?
No, actually, I'm in San Francisco, I think.
Oh.
And you're coming here soon.
Yeah, I am.
But I might not
so,
see
you. WePop is a product designer, but also went to the French Culinary Institute and worked with us. So he knows that we can very easily overstuff a full-size Lexan, but this isn't designed for that. It's designed for people at home, right?
Right.
So when are you going to get one for us to play with?
As soon as possible.
Right.
We're about to go into production in China. I leave San Francisco on August 1st, and we'll be in China for a long time until we'll supervise everything until delivery, basically.
All right. Well. Listen. Congratulations on the new product. And I might just miss you. I think I fly out when you fly back. When you get back in the country, you know, come and say howdy. We love ourselves some WePop.
We will.
Yeah.
But yeah, for anyone out there who's never been to Booker and Backstage Bar in New York City, you need to go, because not only that the cocktails are amazing. If you take your dates there, it's gonna feel the deal.
Hey, check this out. For those of you that don't know, WePop was our very first caller ever into the radio show, ever.
Is that true?
And WePop, very first caller of all times. And from Bangkok, by the way. And you know, for those of you that go to the bar, we have a Thai basil drink on the menu, but I don't know why they call it Thai basil, because, you know, we're actually going to make a holy basil drink coming up soon, because we have a regular Italian globe-style basil drink that we really like, but we don't want to put 2 basil drinks on the menu, because that's weird. But if we put 3 basil drinks on, and turns out Nastasha grows a boatload of holy basil in her backyard. What about that, WePop?
That sounds great.
Yeah. We're just going to call the drink holy basil. Holy basil! That's what we're going to call the drink. What do you think? Sounds good, right? I don't know what's in it yet. We've got to get the basil and play around with it, but it's going to be there. Don't worry about it. We're going to have, like, 3 basil drinks. We're going to go basil crazy for the midsummer push. All basil, all the time. Anyway.
All basil.
All right, WePop, listen. Have a good time in China building your product. We can't wait. Congratulations on the new venture.
All right. Thank you so much.
Bye.
All righty. All right, so let's take one more quick break and come back with a little more cooking issues.
Message from Bushwick Block Party on Saturday, July 28th from noon to midnight.
Sabado. Saturday, July 28th. It's a party in the street.
Fiesta en la calle.
La musica.
Soft spot.
Cookies.
Silicone sister.
Eyes.
Your youth.
Natural child.
Tournament.
The MC Todd experience featuring Bo Breezy, Sam Weiss, and Boston's best hip-hop group, Gray Sky Appeal.
Gang signs.
Wild Yaks.
No.
Solo performances by
Heath
the Goss Racist.
Andrew W.K.
In the Roberta's Garden.
Exclusive Tiki Disco.
DJ.
Amy Pryor, Ortega III.
Boinski.
Ali Escobar.
Night Show.
Max Sussman.
Activitas.
Waterworld.
Photo Booth by Ryan Slack.
Death Killer Steel Cage Match featuring Joe Stone.
Bikini Contest.
Dirt Pie.
Shark
Girls.
Balls.
Comida.
Momo.
Sushi Shack.
Buddha Cafe.
Bird
Shawarma.
Heritage Foods.
USA.
Arancini Brothers.
Imperial Woodpecker Snowball.
Dessert by Katie P.
Yuji Ramen.
Brooklyn Star.
Crack Dogs.
Sponsored by, in Spanish,
Vitamin Water.
Wonton Foods.
Wonton
Fans.
Martin Greenfield Cloviers.
Momo Sushi Shack.
Roberto.
Death Killers of Bushwick.
Union Beer.
Green Fitness.
Heritage Radio. HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Main Track. Dr. Bobby Buka, Dermatology. Jelly NYC.
Free pizza from 12 to 2 while supplies last. Limited to one margarita pizza per person. Acoustic performances from dear old pals and free advice. No sharks will be harmed in the making of this block party. Possible performance from Joe Bickle.
Somehow some weird thing happened with the phone guy. Just going, sorry to folks out there.
Must have been that block party commercial. Hey, we've only got a few minutes left, Dave. We got a 1 o'clock, so.
All right, cool. So I only have one last question, so I'll take it right now. Brian writes in, hi, guys. I saw on Star Chef that you guys use grade C maple syrup at the bar. What does it taste like? I want the smokiest, earthiest, funkiest, mushroomy syrup that there is. When I Googled around about buying some, I saw that it's only for commercial applications. I also saw that they may have changed the rating system, so that grade C is now grade B. Also, the Canadian rating system is different. What's the deal, and where can I get it? Thanks again, Brian. All right, Brian. What I did was I called up the maple syrup producer and said, hey, listen, can I have some grade C maple syrup? I know you have it. And he said, all right, don't tell anyone. Because I guess he didn't have a label for it or whatever. He poured it into a quart, container, a quart maple syrup container, to slap two B's on it, which was the code for C grade, and I bought it at the regular price. Now, those of you that didn't hear anything before, that we say the C grade maple syrup, maple syrup, when it starts its run at the beginning of the season, is the lightest and kind of least, has the least congeners, the least kind of flavor in it. And then as the season progresses, it gets more and more congeners and gets darker and has kind of more and more different flavors. I like the grade C, but it can be a little weird. It doesn't necessarily play nice with other ingredients the way that B does. I mean, I use B in cooking at home. I use B on pancakes. I use B in drinks, and I think every bartender I know uses B in drinks. C was a little rough on some of the drinks that we tried it out. I like it. It's really intense, but it can almost go metallic in certain applications. But it's definitely something you should try to have around, and hopefully that helps. This has been Cooking Issues.
Vicious vodka. Oh, you dirty rat. Got me on this corner, and I don't know.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.